Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Wednesday, February 25th. The national conversation is around the State of the Union. The president thinks it's stronger than ever. Agree or disagree? We get local reaction. An inaugural summit at the East-West Center just concluded, drawing State Department, military officials, Pacific Island leaders, and private businesses to talk about investment possibilities around shared prosperity and security. We talk about plug-in solar, how it's just getting on its feet in this country. And on this week's Manu Minute, we introduce you to the notorious jungle fowl that wakes us up in the morning. And featherwork gets into the limelight in an art exhibit. We consider the intricacies of the feather lay. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Affordability was the word on everyone's lips at President Donald Trump's State of the Union address last night. Take a listen to part of his nearly two-hour speech.
Now the same people in this chamber who voted for those disasters suddenly use the word affordability, a word they just used it. Somebody gave it to them, knowing full well that they caused and created the increased prices that all of our citizens had to endure. You caused that problem. You caused that problem.
And this morning, we bring you more reaction from our Hawaii delegation. Democratic Senator Brian Schott said, a year into this administration, what is clear is that they're not doing enough to make life more affordable for people in Hawaii. Costs are going up. People are losing their health care, and housing remains unaffordable, end quote. Senator Mazie Hirono weighed in with this. Donald Trump spewed more lies in an attempt to distract from the chaos, cruelty, corruption, and incompetence that have come to define his second term in Hawaii. In Hawaii and across the country, families are living with fear and uncertainty about paying their bills, being torn apart, and the safety of our nation, all because of Trump and his lawless regime. And Representative Ed Case had this to say about affordability. He scoffed at it. He avoided it. He explained it away. He blamed it on other people. But he never just said straight up, hey, we've got a challenge of cost of living and affordability, and this is what we need to do about it. Representative Jill Takuda said, let's not mislead America with pretty statements that sound good, but have no proof, no resources, not even programs to be able to back it up. Takuda also spoke on immigration enforcement and the ongoing partial government shutdown. She said, we're asking for the most simple of things because Americans are dead and being threatened in our streets right now. So it may not have happened in Hawaii yet, but it's happening across our country. So we absolutely demand the guardrails. And this morning, we talked to University of Hawaii political scientist Colin Moore about Trump's high-stakes speech.
The start of this was a pretty disciplined speech for Trump. His cabinet has been trying to get him to focus more on affordability issues, to do a little less score settling, and try to explain why the tax cuts and, you know, some of the economic policies are going to benefit Americans. And I think he started off the speech by mainly doing that. So you have the first part of the speech, maybe the first 30 minutes or so that was mainly focused on that. And then you switched to, you know, a more familiar mode for Trump, which was more attacks on Democrats, became far more combative. And, you know, the theatrical part of it, which is always part of any Trump speech, was there. Introducing the gold medal winning men's hockey team, of course, was a classic Trump moment. I mean, and that was one of the few moments in the whole speech that got applause from everybody, including the Supreme Court justices. So overall, I think he accomplished what his team wanted him to accomplish in the first 30 minutes, which was to focus more on the economy and affordability. And then it began to wander in the next hour, and it became a little more combative, you know, a little more like a campaign rally. I mean, to my mind, that's one of the interesting things about how these State of the Union speeches have evolved. There's, especially under President Trump, there's not a whole lot of time spent introducing new programs. That's seeming more like a campaign rally. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not really sure how much impact these speeches have anymore. I don't really see them persuading voters who are, you know, still open to much persuasion. I mean, in some ways, the speech itself made for social media, so it can be chopped up and clips can be played for campaign events. And
I was, you know, interested in just the Hawaii lens. You know, I was, you know, looking forward to what he was going to say about tariffs. You know, what was your take on that?
Well, he didn't spend very much time talking about it, other than that he's going to go about it in a different way and reasserting his power to impose these tariffs. I mean, they're probably going to be lower in some cases than some of the initial proposals. But, you know, there was no confrontation or attack of the Supreme Court justices. I think there was some concern that he would do that in the speech, but he didn't. Several of the ones who voted against him in the case were there, and he shook their hand, you know, despite being extremely critical of them just a little while before.
Well, you know, some of the economists that I was talking to, you know, were saying that there's just still so much uncertainty with his policies and the whiplash, you know, on the tariffs, that it doesn't do, you know, much to build confidence.
Yeah, I entirely agree. And he didn't really do much in the speech to provide more explanation about the tariffs. You know, this is what we'll do moving forward. For the amount of focus that has received in the press over the last few days, he spent precious little time on the speech really addressing it.
Any surprises to you?
Surprises? Well, I mean, look, the nature of a Trump speech is that there are surprises built in. And, you know, that's the showmanship of any speech Donald Trump gives. I think, you know, the only surprise was seeing the Mentaki team appear in the Capitol. I don't think that there is anything else, that certainly no policy proposals that I found particularly surprising. I mean, as the speech moved on, you know, his line attacking Democrats as crazy and forcing or trying to ask different members of the audience to stand if they support different policies, I mean, creating an awkward moment for a lot of Democrats. I wasn't so surprised by that, but he's, you know, leaned in even more to these moments that seem really scripted for, you know, later social media than he has even in the past.
You know, the fact that it was 2 hours long, you know, and set a record in that, I mean, in a way it was almost like it was meant to wear you down, kind of similar to his, you know, mode of operation with his national and international policies.
Trump's speeches have been famously long. You know, his last State of the Union was extremely long as well. You know, I think part of this is to provoke a confrontation with some of the members, the Democrats in the audience, and maybe the hope is that as it gets longer, there'll be more opportunity to get a rise out of them. But part of it, and this isn't just my reaction, I think it's the reaction of many people, is that after a while it starts to seem a little boring. I mean, Trump is politically in a bit of trouble. I mean, his approval ratings are around 41%. You know, it's very likely that he will lose the House of Representatives in the midterm. And this speech, you know, if it was designed to really rally the country around his policies, I don't think he managed to accomplish that. I mean, the beginning seemed a little more disciplined, but as the night wore on, it devolved into the familiar Trump attack lines, which, you know, may work later when you know, these are video clips that the campaign uses. But, you know, the only rationale I can think of for having it be that long is, well, that's often how Trump likes to communicate. But also, the longer it went, maybe the hope was that there would be more opportunities for there to be some sort of confrontational moment with the Democrats. And there certainly were a few.
Well, anything else that struck you about that speech and how it could impact Hawaii?
How it would impact Hawaii? I mean, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think we don't know, because we still know so very little about what the new tariffs will look like. And the president spent relatively little time trying to explain that in the speech, in the same way he spent relatively little time talking about Iran. And so, you know, the issues that likely would affect Hawaii the most directly didn't get a lot of time in the speech.
Do you think that this would have swayed any, you know, voters' opinions of him? Do you think his approval rating will sink lower?
Well, I think there's probably a floor in the high 30s because Trump supporters are very loyal. But, you know, there's the potential for it to sink a few points lower. I don't see that this speech really did much to change anyone's mind. You know, there's still the Epstein file controversy haunting the administration. Americans are still very skeptical of his claims around the economy. Ironically, you know, he seems to be facing some of the same skepticism that President Biden faced when he would talk about the growth in the economy and Americans weren't really feeling it. I think in some ways, President Trump in this speech tried the same thing, you know, to talk about how he claims inflation is going down and the cost of goods is going down. But given the polling, Americans really aren't experiencing that. And so, you know, that was the attempt in the speech, but I doubt there was much persuasion, you know, which is typical of a State of the Union speech.
We'll see what the polls say in the next round, and we'll see what the voters think during the next election. But thank you so much, Colin.
My pleasure.
That was University of Hawaii political analyst Colin Moore talking about President Donald Trump's high-stakes speech.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the distance learning executive MBA with healthcare and travel industry tracks. scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
You are invited to play trivia with HPR Generation Listen on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and meet with fellow HPR fans. Generation Listen is an HPR initiative that connects young and young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
At the East-West Center this week, Pacific Island leaders gathered with military and State Department officials and private industry to talk about how to boost investment in the strategic region. The second-in-command at the State Department, Deputy Chris Landau, launched the inaugural summit, billed as the Pacific Agenda, Investment, Security, and Shared Prosperity. It ended with a U.S. commitment to help fund two undersea cables for connectivity in the remote areas, one for the Marshall Islands and one for American Samoa, as well as a commitment behind a new hospital for Palau, with an agreement signed with Architects Hawaii. Deputy Secretary Christopher Landau ended the two-day meeting on a note of possibilities with the private sector companies, both global and local.
So I'm just very grateful for the private sector for recognizing the potential in these relationships and sending such incredible delegations. I've really had some amazing discussions about ways that communications through our modern technology and satellites, the cost of connecting some of these remote islands with new satellites being launched all the time is dropping incredibly rapidly. So you know, just think about what that does for your countries and your economies. It allows some of your young people to live in an island that is maybe only has a few thousand people, but be connected to the entire library of human knowledge over a digital phone, a cellular phone. These are incredible possibilities that never before in human history we have had that ability. Or energy projects that go beyond the traditional importing diesel and bring it up to the port and using the magma that lies underneath your earth to tap into geothermal riches that could actually make this part of the world not only an energy dependent source, but a massive source of energy abundance.
And we also talked to Palau President Surungao Whips Jr. about two other developments with the island nation. The Palau Supreme Court this past weekend denied a restraining order to block a memorandum of understanding between the Trump administration and Palau. The deal would provide $7.5 million in exchange for Palau to accept immigrants that the U.S. wants to relocate from its shores. The Palau Senate opposed the deal. We asked President Whips about getting community buy-in.
Well, it is challenging because it's a controversial issue. But, you know, what I've been explaining to people is that it's really about helping our partner enforce their laws, but also helping those people because, you know, they need jobs, they need opportunities. That's why they're in the United States. So that's what we can provide in Palau. We have 7,000 foreigners that work in Palau already. So adding another 75 really is a very small impact on Palau. So it's a win for the United States, a win for those third country nationals, and it's an opportunity for us to strengthen our relationship with the United States. And the United States has offered to help us with construction of a new hospital, our pension fund, and other important things that we need to be more resilient. And so we're grateful for that. And that's what partnership is all about. They reach out for help. We offered help. And they're also trying to help us. And that's why we're here at this conference. It's about how can we partner together? How can we help each other solve our challenges?
And do you have any say into where, you know, these immigrants are coming from?
Yeah, well, we ask for ones that, first, they have to be countries that we have diplomatic relations with, because that makes it difficult if you don't have diplomatic relations. Second, we said preferably from Asia, so they're closer to home. Yeah, those are the two main criteria. Of course, no criminals. Immigration overstays, yes, but no criminal background, because the U.S. can already move criminals out anyway. So these are people that had tried to seek asylum, but they couldn't, because when they were found working, it was already beyond their term of seeking asylum.
Do you worry that they may become targets?
Well, that's why it's so important to help the people in the community understand these people are not criminals. They're not bad people. They're just people that want to work hard, want a better life, want a safe life. And so we should be welcoming, and we should. But, you know, unfortunately, politics sometimes is ugly. And it's really regrettable that the politicians in Palau, some of them, have taken and made a political issue and try to create division. And what I don't like is that idea that they're bad people and now I want to look at them when they come to Palau, I'm going to be mean to them. We don't want that. Our society was never that way. But unfortunately, because of YouTube and politics, we're trying to bring that side out. And that's not what Palau is. Palau is a welcoming place. We have 7,000 foreigners that live there. They're happy. They work. That's what these people would be.
And then most of the foreigners now are from Bangladesh?
We have Bangladesh. We have Philippines. We even have Uganda. So there's construction workers there that were brought in by a Chinese company that is building a hotel, and they came from Uganda. So we have Uganda, Nigeria, Kenya. We have all over. So it really is, for us, our opportunity to help a friend and a partner.
And then what do you see now?
Well, we're unlocking the potential, because I think a lot of times U.S. companies don't look at the Pacific. Maybe they think it's difficult to operate in. And so it's really important that the government takes the lead, the U.S. government takes the lead and says, here's DFC, here's MCC, here's USTDA. We're out there. Here's the Department of War. We're out there. We want you to invest. We're going to partner with you. We're going to help you with these governments, with the private sector, to get things going. And I think that's the momentum we need. Because otherwise, if there's no effort by government to push their companies, they sometimes always go the easy way. And there's no question. Dealing with small islands, small governments, dispersed all over large distances, is difficult. It takes a little extra effort. But I think what's important is that as a partner, the United States, as a government, as a partner, takes that extra effort and says, your U.S. companies, your ambassadors, get out there and let's figure out what we can do.
And then I understand that the U.S. may also try and help with the problem with monkeys that you folks have on a particular island.
Oh, well, yeah, that was one of the things that I've been trying to promote is, you know, we have monkeys, macaques, that were brought into Palau at the turn of the century when the Germans were there, early 1900s. And when they were brought in because there was phosphate mining. So they were used as kind of the canary in the coal mine. They took them down there, but they stayed and they multiplied. And there's many of them now. And actually they're invasive. So They destroy crops and they're a nuisance to the community. And what's been happening over the years is the people kill them, shoot them, because they're just a problem. But there is an opportunity because CDC, Department of Defense, medical research, they need these non-human primates. They are the number one species that they use to help. Like when they were developing the COVID vaccine, that's what they used.
They're test animals.
They're test animals. So what we want to be able to do is, you know, maybe help our partner, whether it's the government coming in and trying to help us domesticate and capture these primates, or private sector company coming in and doing it, because there's a big need for medical research. I think the number one exporter in the world right now is Mauritius. They send a lot of them to the United States. The United States needs thousands of them every year.
This could be a solution for a problem and a problem for us.
Yes, it's kind of one of those win-win situations. But most importantly, it helps save lives, right? And, you know, they treat them very well. They were explaining, if the Department of War was able to set up a facility, I mean, it would be like what they do in Fort Detrick. These animals would be air-conditioned, they'd be fed, they'd be taken care of. And, you know, it brings in high-end jobs, it brings in the use of technology and biotech and biomed and, you know, things that could change the future and save so many lives. And that's, I think, the opportunity where we can all win together. And that's what this conference is about.
We also got the chance to talk with Guam Governor Lou Leon-Guerrero about what the U.S. territory was focused on during this summit. Aviation, sea mining, and workforce capacity were key issues. Guam is in the midst of an intense buildup of its military installations.
One of our biggest issues right now that we're facing in Guam is we have a demand of jobs and we don't have the supply from a local workforce. So we actually bring in foreign H-2B workers. And one of the things that has been quite limiting for us is the U.S.'s restrictions on the number of H-2B workers that we can bring in. And so we're trying to work to sort of kind of lessen that restriction or sort of relieve that restriction, and bringing in those workforce will help us. But in terms of how we work ourselves locally, we work very closely with our Trades Academy. We work very closely with the Guam Community College to provide boot camps so we can provide areas of skills in construction primarily, and also in hospitality and healthcare. And of course, we have vocational tracks in our high schools that some of the students are taking advantage of. So we're being very innovative and creative in ways that we can, I guess, expand more our workforce capacity.
Yeah. And has the administration been receptive to the calls to allow for, you know, those H-2 workers?
So our congressional delegate is working very closely with the Secretary of Labor. He's also working very closely with his colleagues in Congress. So we're trying to remove some provisions in the federal policy that would allow us to be able to bring in workforce laborers from foreign countries to do civilian projects, civilian construction. Right now, the law allows you to bring in for military construction, but we need help bringing in for civilian construction work. And so we sort of there's a workaround we've done administratively, but we would like to permanently correct that. Of course, their biggest concern is overstay, right? But in Guam, they don't overstay. Where are they going to go? It's an island. And we have very good compliance program that really goes to these construction sites. So we're pretty compliant in the rules. And so we're trying to work through the NDAA and through Congress to see how they can lift those restrictions.
How many workers Guam currently has under the H-2?
Yeah, there's about maybe, I want to say 6,000. We used to be zero. Now we're up to 6,000. We're thinking we need at least 9,000 to 10,000, 12,000 to provide for the workforce capacity for construction.
They come mainly from Philippines,
yeah,
Vietnam?
Primarily Philippines, yeah. They've broken out into roundtable discussions, and, you know, our delegation sped ourselves over to be able to participate in those discussions. I primarily sat in on the critical minerals discussion because that's one of the biggest concerns we're starting to see in terms of exploratory deep sea mining research in our area, especially near the Marianas Trench. And so I know there's been a lot of media coverage on that. So at that table, you know, it was Cook Islands, and Cook Islands is primarily advanced in their exploratory license. And the way it works is license really is for exploratory research. And then once they explore and do the research and the country says, yes, we're okay, then they go into deep sea mining, harvesting, right? They're not there yet. And it's a lot of the work still being done around exploratory science, data, information. And our position in Guam is right now we want to put a moratorium on any of this until we get really good, sufficient scientific data, information, and so forth, or even learning the process so we can better understand. But one thing that was very common among all the island leaders there was we all want to protect our environment. And how can we find the balance of protecting our environment and still getting some economic benefits, you know, from the deep sea mining? And I also learned that companies that are there wanting to explore are also very concerned about protecting the environment. And they talk about having high environmental standards and regulations to work under, and also making sure that their technology and their resources don't impact on the environment.
How concerned are you, you know, with all this renewed interest in nuclear, that they may try and, you know, use the Pacific as a dumping ground again?
Yeah, of course, nuclear is not a very good topic among our Pacific Islanders and also throughout because they've had really tragic, horrendous experience with nuclear testing. And so that's going to be a very uphill battle, I think, in terms of trying to convince our leaders and our community, right? And I know that science and technology has advanced nuclear energy to a point where they say it's safe, but I don't think our people, they don't really want to chance it. And I think we can use other alternative energy like solar, like thermal, you know, and areas like that.
That was Guam Governor Lou Leon Guerrero, who is one of several Pacific leaders attending the inaugural Pacific Agenda Summit at the East-West Center, which concluded last night. At the summit's conclusion, Indo-Pacific Command also announced that the U.S. would fund a position based in Honolulu to prosecute immigration crimes.
Support for HPR comes from Amy Greenwell Ethnobotanical Gardens Grow Hawaiian Festival in South Kona on Hawaii Island this Saturday, featuring keiki activities open to all. AmyGreenwell.garden.
President Trump had to go convince Americans in this speech that the evidence indicated that they didn't need to feel this economically insecure. I don't think he met that. He had to go lay out a rationale for why we may be at war in the next couple of days. He certainly didn't do that.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. The retrospective Toshiko Takaezu, Worlds Within, covers 70 years of her sculptures, paintings, and weavings. On now, HonoluluMuseum.org.
Our next segment looks at what's known as plug-in solar energy. It's just getting its feet squared away here on the ground. Here to talk about it is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote, who covers energy issues for us. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so plug-in solar, big in Europe, just, you know, starting out here in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people want solar energy, but it's out of reach for some reason. Either they can't afford the installation costs, or they don't have access to their own rooftops on which to put a rooftop system. And in Europe, balcony solar offers a solution. It is something that can be as simple as going to a store, buying a solar panel, and then putting in the sun and plugging it into an outlet, and it's able to offset some of the energy use in your home. That's the promise of what plug-in solar could be somewhere in like the United States and already is in countries like Germany.
Yeah, so why can't we just, you know, export that technology from Germany?
That is a great question. It is because the U.S. has a fundamentally different electrical system than much of the world, including Germany. So they all run on 230 volts. We run on 120 volts. We also have our own safety standards and utility structures. So we are rebuilding the wheel when it comes to plug-in solar domestically, but those wheels are moving. I talked to Cora Stryker with Brightsaver, which is a Bay Area nonprofit dedicated to promoting plug-in solar in the U.S., and that organization formed just a year ago, but in that time, they've seen a huge surge in interest in this technology.
We imagined starting a movement and starting really small. We wanted to have 100 households in the Bay Area adopt this stuff. We wanted to have proof of concept, show that people want it. And we set a goal of having 3 states introduce legislation. Today, we're at 29. So I think that we have seen a demand even beyond our wildest dreams.
Yeah, you know, I have experience with the plug-in solar kit. You know, we use it to to energize our fish pond in our backyard.
And because of recognition of people in Hawaii who have high energy rates, who want to bring that burden down, Hawaii is one of those states that's considering legislation that endorses the use of plug-in solar. And so Brightsaver is hoping that in a relatively short time, the U.S. will look more like Germany. So many people like yourself, Catherine, will have households that have plug-in solar available. In Germany, they've already installed over 1 million solar units. They're especially popular with renters who hang them off their apartment balconies. That's one of the names of the solar, balcony solar. That's how it got that name. And these units, they cost a few $1,000s, and they produce enough power to offset an appliance like a small fridge or your laptop use or some of your air conditioning. And Stryker and other proponents really think that this technology has the potential to help people who have been excluded from the residential market, people who don't own roofs or don't have money to invest in a bigger system, and they don't have to worry about permitting costs or installation costs. And if they move, they can take that solar unit with them. So it's basically a big household appliance. But there are still some hurdles facing plug-in solar in the U.S.
So what kinds of hurdles?
Well, as Stryker puts it, plug-in solar exists in this kind of gray area in the U.S. right now. So plug-in solar units, they don't produce that much power. But they are designed to be plugged directly into your building's electrical system. And so utilities have raised concern that somehow if all the power generated by a plug-in solar unit doesn't get sucked up in your home, going to your fridge or your lights or something, it could potentially backfeed onto the grid. And technically, if you have any kind of system that's connected to the grid, you're supposed to have an interconnection agreement with the utility. But that's a barrier that Stryker and other proponents don't want to put on plug-in solar, since the main advantage of this technology is accessibility. It's supposed to be easy. So legislation in different states is clarifying this, and the measures in Hawaii that have been introduced, they may change, but current legislation would exempt units that produce less than 1,200 watts from needing an interconnection agreement. The other barrier is safety standards for plug-in solar equipment. So Utah was the first state to formally greenlight balcony solar through legislation last year, but there was a caveat. They created interconnection exemptions specifically for units that were completely certified by the underwriters' laboratories. And if that name doesn't ring a bell, it's a century-old product testing and safety company. They set standards for thousands of different types of products, everything from smoke alarms to EV batteries. You may have seen a little UL on something
yes.
that you bought before. Yes, and so quite recently, this standard didn't exist. UL had certifications for all the separate parts that go into a plug-in system, but not the whole thing. And that really just changed in January. But some people are still skittish about safety concerns around plug-in solar. So the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Commerce actually just deferred one of the surviving balcony solar bills at the state legislature yesterday. after the Office of the State Fire Marshal and other fire departments raised concerns that the National Electric Code needs to be updated to safely install these systems. But Stryker says legislation is still important to make plug-in solar safe, and it could bring a kind of underground plug-in solar market that exists above board. So in the U.S., people now are plugging these solar units into their homes already. And in some cases, people are installing hardware at their breaker boxes that prevents electricity from flowing onto the grid. It's making these units invisible.
We know people are already installing their DIY systems. They're ordering the inverter and they're ordering their solar panels and they're setting them up in their backyard or on their porch. That is one of the reasons we need legislation, because legislation is establishing safety standards. People are going to do this whether or not it's legal, whether or not it's in this gray area. So we really have to pass legislation that makes it crystal clear, hey, these kinds of systems are safe for consumers and we should enable them and get out of the way so that companies can develop the safest systems possible to sell nationwide.
And so, yeah, I guess, you know, if the legislation passes to set up this framework, then people would have access to these kits pretty quick.
Yeah, if we see the stars align with legislation, which signals to manufacturers this is something people want and that becomes widely available and it's deemed safe, it could soon be like going to the store and buying a new washing machine. That's what it could feel like. There is one exception. In terms of paperwork right now. So current bill language would require customers to register any solar unit that they bought, any portable or balcony solar unit that they bought with the Public Utilities Commission. How about you, Rep. Nicole Lowen, who's been reviewing these measures as the chair of the House Energy and Environmental Protection Committee, said that that registry could offer helpful data about plug-in solar, but other people, they don't want this stipulation. Again, the goal is to make plug-in solar as accessible as possible, so they say get rid of any paperwork around it. And then there are other folks who are supportive of balcony solar, but they also want to make sure the state keeps looking at other ways to make solar energy work for everyone. So Rocky Mold, the head of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, says, yes, bill savings that one might see from plug-in solar are meaningful, but they're just at the margins, right? You're just going to be able to shave off a little bit from your bill. So he doesn't want the state to lose sight of other efforts, like, for instance, redesigning our community-based renewable energy program.
Yeah, lots to weigh there. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Ever thought about raising your own chickens? Well, chickens were likely first domesticated 1,000 years ago from red jungle fowl. Polynesians brought this same red jungle fowl known as the moa to Hawaii, and you can still find some of these birds here today. We got their call thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, University of Hawaii. Hilo Professor Patrick Hart has your Manu Minute.
Moa, or red jungle fowl, were the first birds introduced to Hawaii by humans, as they were brought by Polynesian voyagers to the Hawaiian Islands close to 1,000 years ago. Moa look a lot like modern-day chickens, and recent research has shown that common chickens were domesticated from red jungle fowl over 8,000 years ago in Asia. Moa are a bit smaller than most other chickens, and the males have a classic red, black, and green color pattern in their plumage, whereas regular chickens come in all sorts of color combinations. Moa can also be distinguished by their call. The last syllable in the rooster's four-syllable cock-a-doodle-doo call is much shorter in the moa than the domestic chicken. Here's the call of the moa. And here's the call of the domestic chicken. Moa were once common on all the Hawaiian Islands, but are now mainly found in the dense upland rainforests of Kauai, where they feed on leaves, fruits, and insects in the leaf litter and spread the seeds of a variety of native and non-native plants. Even on Kauai, they've now interbred with domestic chickens to such an extent that they're often hard to tell apart, especially after Hurricanes Iwa and Iniki led to lots of domestic chickens escaping into the wild. A recent genetic study showed that while some birds have retained many of the genes of their Polynesian ancestors, most birds that people mistake for moa are actually just domestic chickens. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Biology Department.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
A young feather worker is taking his first steps out of the nest. Inoka Phillips is 24 and is about to close his second solo exhibition. Halekulani Art Gallery has been home to Nanea Ikahulu for the past month. The title means Delight in the Feathers. The exhibit showcases Phillips' artistry in making feather lei, or lehulu. You may have seen lei made by Phillips on display. It was worn by actress Lucianne Buchanan at the premiere for the Apple TV Plus show Chief of War. Marketing manager Crystal DeRosier told The Conversation's Maddie Bender that she and Phillips put the exhibition together in just 2 weeks. She described shaping its story.
There's a specific cadence that we have in the artworks. It kind of makes like a wave, and he speaks a lot about waves, Nalu, in his work. So just very interesting alignment in how all of this has come together. And I just feel really honored to be able to showcase someone so incredibly talented and such a beautiful soul. He just has, just everyone loves him to be around his energy, and he illuminates the gallery with his work, and it just impacts people in a lot of different ways. And as people have come and seen the work and seen how it was framed and see the execution and all of the choices, all of the minute choices he's made. And then for me, I got to share my, like, how I would hang an exhibit, which was his first time experiencing how to hang an exhibit. So I got to teach him, like, you know, how the center of the artwork needs to be, you know, how many inches from the floor and how long measurement takes. Because he was like, oh, it'll just take a couple hours. I'm like, no, it's going to take a little longer than that. You know, I learned a lot from him, and I think he learned a lot from me, and I just, it was a really beautiful collaboration.
And we took a tour of the exhibit and talked story with Phillips. He begins in front of a golden feather lei tied with a satin bow mounted inside an ornate frame.
This lei was the last lei that I made when I was living in California, and I think, like, for me, like, when I was living in California, like, I got to go to a lot of like the museums, like the Met or the Huntington, and I got to see things that I was like, whoa, kind of like fine art, you know? And I was just like, wow, I want to kind of do that with featherwork. Like, how do I do that with like lehulu and kind of like, I mean, it's already fine art, but how do I take it into like a gallery space, you know? And so this one is really special to me. It's in a first cut poi poi style lehulu that's made with Chinese golden pheasant feathers, and also the framing as well. Growing up in the church, or even just being really inspired by Catholicism and how, you know, I think back about like the artisan of those times, of just religion itself, you know. And it was really my grandparents that really inspired me, because they really devote their lives to their church, and I think we all like know somebody and know, have a family member that really devotes their lives to the church and to God. And I thought about the artisans that would build these churches, these big Catholic churches, and how it's so Gothic and just grand and beautiful, and the arts that's in it. So I thought about the artisan and how they devote their lives to the craft, but they also devote it to God. And to me, that's how I feel about my featherwork, is I do devote it to my featherwork, but at the same time, it's just a love for the featherwork. And so I wanted that duality of my haole side, or my side that is deeply in me in this Christian religion, but also showcasing the koa framing as my Hawaiian side, you know? And in a way, it's like, it's one and the same. And
so it's really like, it's a lei that represents you in a lot of ways. I did want to just describe this for the listener, because I think what is so interesting about your practice is that you provide artistry not only into the making of the lei itself, but the koa frame, like you said. There's this ornate, like, gold leaf rim to the frame, and then it's mounted on canvas. I think all going toward the point that you made of how do you make this look like fine art? How do you make this look like something that belongs in a museum?
Well, also, it's like very Renaissance. I love the Renaissance. I mean, just the things that was made at that time and how it continuously inspires us today. You know, you see it even in like Iolani Palace and Queen Emma Summer Palace. You know, like, it's always inspired. I've always loved that vibe too. And so just to be able to make my own framing, you know, or design my own framing like that. Then for this piece, okay, this is one of my favorite pieces for the show. So I had a dream about a bird taking a bath in a puddle of mud. My good friend Tamiko made these. And so I met with her and I was like, you know, I have this vision of feathering a pot. And she made these, and this was our collaboration together. And have you ever seen a bird take a bath before? You know how like they dip inside and they shake their body? And that's what inspired me to make these pots, just like it like puffs up, you know? And so that's kind of inspired me to make these feathered pots. Yeah.
There's something so playful about it.
Well, I think birds are playful. And I think that's what I also see with featherwork, is the embodiment of the birds as well, you know, where I think we're playful. And I feel like, I hope I show that like in my work, that it doesn't just have to be like serious, you know, it could be playful. And it is playful because birds are playful. But I think there's also, I guess there's both sides to it, right? There's like this playfulness, but there's also this elegance and grace and two birds, you know, this very angelic, heavenly beings, you know?
And then just so we can describe for the listeners, oh, this is so fun to look at. We have these two. Is it ceramic? Is it like clay pots?
Ceramics. Yeah. But also, I think it was also the combining of the birds that live in the Vau'aku, or live in these heavenly sky realms, but also combining them to the earth, you know? And so that was another thing as well. It's playing with the, it's the duality of them, you know, of land and sky.
Do you think of, so there's a yellow one and it's shorter and stouter, and a red one that is taller and more elongated, and they have different feathers in each. Do you think of the two of them as different birds?
Oh, definitely. Well, okay. So for this smaller, or the elongated one, I was going to put the same feathers in it, but then I had, so these are Chinese golden pheasant tail feathers, and then these are the body feathers. But I just love the look of it, how this one is more small and compact, and it's more fun size. But then this one is somewhat more, I don't know, maybe serious, I guess. I don't know, more spiky and more, I don't know, you know. But I wanted them to like complement each other, and I felt like this was actually way better than I thought of. I think something that's very true to my work is keeping everything very traditional. So it might not look traditional, but actually the process is traditional. So these are called uos, or they're like bundles of feathers. And that is the foundation of Hawaiian featherwork. That's what really sets Hawaiian featherwork apart from other types of featherwork, is the bundling of the feathers. So traditional native honeycreepers, the feathers are about the size of your fingernail. So they're pretty small. And what our kupuna would do is that they would take the feathers, maybe like 2 to 5 feathers, and bundle them together. And that was like your one feather. And so you could only imagine, like, so like if you look at my leis now, like, or just leis in general, that's one feather. But imagine you had to like make 3 feathers, wool them, bundle them, and then that's one. So it's like way more feathers. But that was like the foundation of everything, from kahili, from lehulu, from ahu'ula, mahi'ole. And, you know, it's taking that traditional techniques and using them in contemporary forms. But, you know, like I said, it's just like, it's having fun with it. It's not being too serious about it. And just, I mean, I guess it is being serious about it, but like also not holding yourself to like this box, because birds don't live in a box. So why should I?
Is there anything else you want to talk about in here before we go?
Yeah, I guess what we're looking at the display case of the gallery. So in this case, I have a lot of my humupapa work, and humupapa is the hat band or the flat leis. And so in this case, I have 2 humupapas I did, and there's 3 humupapas that was actually my great-grandmother Libby's lei hulu. And so when I started making lei hulu back in 2018 with my kumu Florence Makiko, I just fell in love with the work, you know, and it just felt so natural, and it felt like I've done it before, but I just loved it. And not until December of that year, Christmas time, that we're sitting all with my family, my grandma Rhoda, she brings out an ube container. And you know how like people keep it in like the Cool Whip containers, the poke containers. And so she just had it in a ube ice cream container, and she brought out this container, and it was full of my grandmother's lei hulus. And she was like, oh, I wanted to show this to you. And it was like so surprising, because no one in my family knew that my grandmother made lei hulu, you know. And it was just this like, oh my gosh, what? And my mom didn't know, my uncles and my aunties didn't know. They were so surprised as well, because in my family we always knew that my grandma quilted, and so that's what we knew. And so like even more, I was like, okay, my great grandmother quilted, and so maybe that's why the stitching is easy. But she made all types of lei hulu, and so even more, it was that like reconnection, and that I guess it was like kind of felt like a purpose, you know. Now that I was learning this, like I feel like I gotta just continue this hana, and to be honest, I really enjoyed doing it, and that's really what kind of just kept me going. And so I wasn't gonna put it in here, to be honest. I like, you know, when it's a family heirloom, you kind of like keep it to yourself. But you know what, my grandma was actually the one where she was like, and uncle, why don't you put Tutu's leis in there? I was like, oh, you think I should? And she was like, yeah, you should show off Tutu's leis, you know. And so even more too, I'm so glad it's here at Halekulani, and it just means so much to me. And kind of just to see, like, my favorite thing to do is seeing my grandmother's featherwork, of that technique, you know, and seeing how it's very timeless, you know what I mean. I feel like if I didn't tell you, or I didn't tell anybody, you would look like it was just made yesterday. But I don't even know when she made these, like maybe like 1950, or you know what I mean? They're super old, but they're still good as new.
And they're displayed in a nicer way than in an ube ice cream box.
Yes. Yes, no. Well, actually, can I say something? They're not in an ube container anymore. They're actually in a Swiffer container. Because my kumu, Auntie Flo, she would keep all of her lei hulus in those blue Swiffer containers. And so I just keep that tradition alive. But I think, you know, I think that's another thing too as well, like seeing that older generation always keeping those containers. There's something so special about them, you know. And I'm trying to think of the word, like, it's like sustainable. You know what I mean? It's never throwing anything away. It's always using what you have. And like, and I've always loved that. And I think that's what featherwork really speaks, is aloha aina. You know, if the aina is my ka'i, then everything else is, you know, and even the hulu, the birds and the fish and everything. So that's what I see with it, you know.
And that was artist Inoka Phillips, and HPR's Maddie Bender. Phillips shares that his goal is to one day create a house entirely covered in feathers. Phillips' featherwork exhibit at the Halekulani Art Gallery will be closing tomorrow, but you can catch him teaching classes in lei hulu making. You can find out dates and more on his Instagram at Inoka Phillips. And we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at a measure to require hundreds of inmates now in Arizona prisons to be sent back home to Hawaii. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.